I'd like to open up a question and answer discussion just by asking you about some of the events, as Macmillan would have said, the events that may intrude over the course of the year, Middle East events, that may have an impact on the dynamics you both spoke about, hopeful events and negative events, and ask you for your view on their political implications at home. The most hopeful event, obviously, would be some sort of breakthrough in Arab-Israeli peace. Would this provide a halo effect for Republicans because the Americans might have played an important role in it? And then on the negative side, it was noticed by Rudy Giuliani in the New Hampshire debate that that George Bush doesn't get enough credit for the absence of terrorism in the United States since 2001. Would there be a political impact of a terrorist attack against Americans, a major terrorist attack against Americans over the course of the next year? So the good news and the bad news and its political implications. Gentlemen, because of the cameras, if I can ask you to speak from the microphone up here.
All right, I'll go first and then Michael can go ahead. I don't think an Israeli-Palestinian peace deal would have a very big impact on the election. I think, if anything, it will just convince Americans that things around the world are not as bad as they thought and that we can focus on the domestic things that really trouble us. I disagree with John McCain that George W. Bush didn't get credit for there not being another terrorist attack. I actually think it was an important part of the reason he won in 2004. I think there were a significant number of swing voters who thought, well, if we haven't had another terrorist attack, George W. Bush must be doing something right. I think he did get some credit for that. If there were another terrorist attack in 2008, I would guess that it would benefit a Republican like John McCain were he the nominee. It's worth noting that amongst people who say that terrorism is their number one issue as opposed to Iraq, those people lean very heavily Republican. Terrorism, separate from Iraq, barely registers amongst Democratic exit polls. It does register amongst Republicans. Amongst people in 2004 exit polls who said that terrorism, as opposed to Iraq, was their number one issue, George W. Bush beat John Kerry 86-14. So to the degree that you raise terrorism as an issue, I think that probably helps the Republicans.
Yeah, I tend to agree with what Peter said about the Israeli-Palestinian agreement. For one thing, George W. Bush is not on the ballot. As he noted, the Republicans have candidates, by and large, have created a certain degree of separation from Bush. I think that it would not have a huge impact. I'm trying to recall the negotiations that were going on in 2000, which really much of which happened after the election, but did not seem to have a big impact in the 2000 presidential election. As for the possibility of a terrorist attack, I suppose that if it is seen as the result of administration incompetence, it could redound to it would hurt George Bush. I think that the more likely response is what Peter described, a kind of rallying around the president. But once again, the president isn't on the ballot. And I think the issue in November, the salience of which would be probably increased by a terrorist attack, is who can protect the country better, which of the two nominees can do a better job of this. And this is a dimension, one of the few dimensions, on which Republicans potentially have an advantage over Democrats. Just want to say one point in clarification about Peter's opening remarks. I did not say that Obama has argued that his fact that he has Muslim descent or his father was a Muslim or whatever would make him more acceptable to the Muslims around the world. I think some of his supporters have made that argument, I think it's a naive one. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll open the floor to questions. If you could please make sure that you speak into a microphone and that the microphone is has the light on when you do speak into it. I'll start up in front with Ambassador Lewis and work our way around.
One Middle East and one more general. On the bad things that could happen, Rob's point. Neither of you mentioned Pakistan. It seems to me that this year, a disaster in Pakistan is probably much more likely than a big disaster terrorist event in the United States. How would that affect the campaign? For Michael, history shows us that when you have an impending or beginning recession that's being felt pretty widely in a presidential year, it really is a big handicap for the party in power. What do you think would be the impact of the rather beginnings of recession deepening over the next 6 months?
I will take a couple of questions before I turn to the panelists. On my left, Hillel Weinberg.
I've been a little surprised that at the lack of reaction, at least perceived reaction in the Jewish community, to the beating up of Hillary Clinton over her vote on this rather innocuous provision relating to Iran. And I was wondering whether other people share that and have noticed that, whether the panels have noticed that, and what whether there has been a reaction that maybe I just haven't noticed myself.
Thank you. Maury Amitai in the center.
Some of the candidates you spoke about have foreign policy experience and record, particularly someone like John McCain, who's been in the Senate for so many years. What role do advisors to some of the candidates without this experience have? Many people are more concerned about the people who might be advising Obama, for instance, someone like Brzezinski, who's supposed to be one of his advisors. What role do advisors play, and do you think that it's worth taking a look and who is close to the candidates in foreign policy and Middle East issues?
Okay, why don't we start with those three questions? Gentlemen, Peter, you want to go first this time?
Okay, sure. On the question about Pakistan, I think we had a pretty good trial run of this with the assassination of Benazir Bhutto just before the Iowa caucuses. And as far as I can tell, it had no impact whatsoever. I mean, think about the way Mike Huckabee reacted to that. I mean, it seemed to me he did everything possible in the wake of that to make you concerned that he wasn't quite up to snuff on some of these foreign policy issues. First saying that they should revoke martial law when they had, then saying that the real concern was Pakistanis coming across the border. It didn't hurt him at all. I mean, his momentum moved straight through. So I think I would take the lesson from that even when you have a really significant foreign policy crisis that got a lot of attention in the press, when it doesn't have to do with young Americans dying, and it doesn't have a really tangible effect on Americans like something that jacked up the price of oil, for instance, that the effect was relatively minor. I mean, the candidates talked about it, but I can't for the life of me, maybe Michael can, see that it had any impact on the Iowa results at all. On the question of Jewish reaction to Hillary Clinton being beaten up on the question of her vote to designate the Revolutionary Guards a terrorist group, I think it's important to remember that, and I don't have polling at my fingertips, but I know that there's polling on Iraq. I don't know if there's polling on Iraq. Most polls are more dovish, even significantly more dovish, than both Catholics and Protestants when it comes to war and peace issues. And that's certainly going to go for Jews who are going to be voting in Democratic primaries. I think that while there's obviously concern in the Jewish community about Iran, about the things that Ahmadinejad has said about Israel, and there's great concern amongst Jewish leadership, I don't think that I think the argument that I think American Jews, my guess would be, if you asked the question about should we be willing to undertake military action against Iran to prevent them from having a nuclear weapon, if I had to bet, I would bet that Jews would be more dovish on that question than Catholics and Protestants. I think that's something that people with this omnipresent kind of neoconservative kind of mantra that we constantly hear all the time forget is how genuinely dovish the American Jewish community remains overall. There are obviously disagreements, but overall. On the question about advisors, yes, I think advisors are enormously important, although I think that it's worth noting that most big campaigns have a diversity of advisors. I mean, look at the Bush campaign in 2000. You had people like like Colin Powell and Rich Armitage. And then you also had people like Paul Wolfowitz. So advisors are influential, but it's hard to know which advisors really have the candidate's ear. And also, a candidate will want a broad array of advisors, partly so they can put people forward who will reassure various different groups. And so while advisors are important to study, it's not always you can't always find a really kind of clear line between the different advisors, particularly in a big campaign like the Clinton campaign or the Obama campaign.
Michael?
Thank you. Pakistan disaster. I think Peter's right about Iowa. Maybe it helped John McCain get his great strength. In fact, one of the mysteries of polling right now is that the votes shifted over Christmas time in the Republican race, nationally and in the various states, towards McCain. Nobody did any polling until, with one exception, nobody did any polling from, December 21st to December 27th. She was assassinated on December 27th. I hadn't thought of that, but maybe that has an effect. I don't think it would have a big effect among Democratic primary voters. I think very many of them basically believe that once we get rid of that horrible Texan with his swagger, we will be loved in the world once again, and we will not have any problems or people wanting to attack us because they'll recognize that the good guys are back in power and everything will be fine. We'll go back on holiday from history. And so I don't think the fact that almost none Democratic voters think that terrorism is an important problem or one of the most important problems, I think tends to support that view. Iran as a terrorist nation, I would make one addendum here. One of the few areas where George W. Bush's support increased substantially among Jewish voters was Beverly Hills, California. Iranians. There's an Iranian Jewish mayor now of Beverly Hills. And so the south of Wilshire is now a heavily Iranian Jewish area. The Iranian Jews know that Iran is a problem and that they're not going to think we're all just lovely once we get a Democrat back in the White House. Their problems with us go back long before George W. Bush. But I think the attacks on Hillary are an attempt to go after that left-wing constituency in the Democratic Party that thinks there's, a conspiracy to make war on Iran and so forth. The foreign policy advisors, I agree with what Peter says. You never know for sure who's going to be the most influential foreign policy advisor. My observation within administrations is that you may not know it from day to day and on issues. Why did everybody stay up late at Bill Clinton's White House? Because Clinton stayed up late, and if you wanted to get in the last word with him, you better be prepared to stick around till midnight or 1 a.m. or whatever else. With Bush, who is an early riser, what you have to do, any scheduled meeting with Bush, you want to be there 15 minutes early because he's liable to be 10 minutes early and start the meeting right there. So it goes in the other direction on the clock, but we never know. Beginning of recession, I think the old rules about the role of economics in politics no longer apply. I think the political science rules that said that the elections are largely a verdict on the condition of the macroeconomy were a product of observations that were made when most voters remembered the Great Depression of the 1930s. The percentage of voters that remember the Great Depression of the 1930s in 2004 was 4%. That number is not going up. And I think that when you look at polling on the economy now, you see an interesting phenomenon. When you ask Americans what they think of the economy, they don't actually give you their observation. They tell you which party they belong to. In 99 and 2000, when you asked them about the condition of the economy, when the economy was roaring along, Republicans said, it's terrible. There's no good economy. For the last 7 years, when you ask people about in periods which have basically been pretty good for the economy by any historic measure, while the economy is going for the past 6 years, Democrats, and for the past 3 years, Independents, that economy is no good. Basically, what they're telling you is not that the economy is no good, but that they're a Democrat or they're a Republican. And clearly, with Democrats and Independents all sharing that feeling now, we're going to see people talking about the economy. The curious thing is, what are the two parties proposing to do to improve the economy? The answer is precious little. The basic policy tools are more in the hands of the chairman of the Federal Reserve than of the president or the Congress. The Democrats' tax policy is to have taxes, at least on high earners, rise when they are scheduled to do so, as they are currently scheduled to do so in 2010. When I was a Democrat, I never thought that higher taxes was a good cure for recession. I thought that was Herbert Hoover's remedy, and we know how it worked for him. It strikes me that we're not hearing very much that's serious in the way of improving the economy, and that may be for a more underlying reason, which is that for the last 25 years, we've been in low inflation economic growth about 95% of the time. If you go back and look at what economists were saying at the beginning of that period, particularly Democratic and liberal economists, but economists of all stripes, they were saying, you Americans have got to be grown-ups, be adults, and you need to realize that the days of low inflation economic growth are gone and they're never going to come back. It's never going to happen. Well, it's been true 95% of the time now. I think most voters take that as the floor, the bedrock. Of course there's low inflation economic growth, but hey, gas prices are high, or, it's getting harder to get a mortgage or something like that. Politically, I suppose it's better, probably more profitable and advantageous to attend to, perhaps, to those or address those specific complaints rather than make promises about the macro economy that you don't have policies to match. Thanks.
Thank you. I have a series of questions that I wanted to put on the table. You just very briefly and in passing mentioned gasoline prices, but neither of you in your opening comments said a word about oil, which is, of course, has a Middle East connection. In 2004, John Kerry tried to run, made the Bush Arab oil producer connection a theme of his foreign policy. We haven't heard it very much in this election. We have heard a lot about alternative energy and energy policy, but we haven't heard the Middle East oil connection. Do you expect that to emerge at all as an issue as we proceed? The one big advisor that, of course, will become an issue at some point, if indeed his wife becomes the candidate, is Bill Clinton, who is an advisor unlike no other advisor. And he, of course, has a considerable Middle East legacy that one can interpret in various ways. But do you expect Bill Clinton himself, at what point do you expect him to become an issue? And then you made a very interesting point, Peter, when you talked about how the current generation of Democrats, you think, are less likely to try to run to the right on certain issues. Now, Bill Clinton did try to run to the right of Bush the Elder on China and even on a Middle East issue. I remember remember clearly being in the room when he excoriated Bush the Elder for being soft on Syria. And then, as I said earlier, John Kerry tried to run to the right of Bush the Younger on relationships with Saudis, and we need to be tougher on these. Is there no safe area, put it that way, a safe area for Democrats in 2008 to run to the right of this president or the likely candidate? Three questions for you. Gentlemen?
Well, we have heard some talk about gas prices and oil and the danger of over-reliance on the Middle East for oil. I think we've heard some from John McCain. I think we've heard from some other Rudy, I think, and I think some of the Democrats have talked about this as well, energy independence. That's the continuing mantra, and you have some national security hawks like Jim Woolsey, who has been advocating, sort of non-market-based alternative fuel problems, specifically on national security grounds. We don't want to have to depend on the people whom he and some others refer to as our enemies, the Saudis. who supplied us with 15 of the 19 September 11th hijackers. The question about Bill Clinton, you know, Hillary Clinton in some ways has the same problem Al Gore had in 2000, which is how do you use Bill Clinton to advantage? And it's an unsolvable problem. On the one hand, a majority of Americans think Bill Clinton was an effective and competent president, and having him have access, presumably, close access to the next president would therefore seem to be an asset, a political asset for Hillary Clinton. On the other hand, and this is really unique in presidential history, a majority of Americans consider Bill Clinton to be an unreliable liar and a person of poor moral character. They are not eager, it seems to me, for more soap opera. You know, given that, Bill Clinton is a liability. And so he's really both. There's the danger that he might overshadow his wife when she's seeking to be commander-in-chief. I don't think Americans have fully worked their way through this particular set of issues. I heard after the Iowa caucuses and when some people were prematurely supposing that the Clinton era in national politics was over, I heard sighs of relief not only from some Republican friends, but also from some Democratic friends. So I think, it is slightly bizarre to suppose that we elect a president who's still very active and energetic spouse is a former president. We haven't had anything like this in our history. Is there room for Democrats to run to the right of Republicans? Well, Peter Beinart's written a book that's sort of about this subject, so I'll leave that to him.
Let me go through quickly. Energy independence is a very popular issue in both parties. It may be the single most popular foreign policy proposal in any audience, and it says something about the mood of the American people when energy independence, which is really an anti-foreign policy proposal when you think about it, it's really about disengaging us from the Middle East so we don't have to worry as much about it, is actually probably the biggest applause line, certainly in a Democratic audience and maybe in a Republican audience. And I think this is one of those few areas where there's actually a lot of room for bipartisanship. I mean, there are differences on economics, but on the goal, there's a lot of agreement. In fact, we saw a bill coming out of Congress that Bush signed that had bipartisan support. I basically agree with Michael on Bill Clinton. He's an enormous strength and a serious liability. I think Hillary Clinton has shown that she's not going to try to do what Al Gore did, if it were even realistic. Certainly in the Democratic primary, I think the strengths significantly outweigh the liabilities. Bill Clinton is popular amongst Americans. They think his presidency was a success, I think even more than they did when he left office, but particularly amongst Democrats. He's very, very popular amongst Democrats, very popular amongst African Americans, which Hillary Clinton needs to not get blown out amongst African Americans. He's someone who you can send out and raise money. He's someone who can draw very big crowds. He gives you the ability to be in two states at the same time. Those are very significant. And I think he does. He does certainly for Democrats. I think underscore Hillary Clinton's experience argument, because there is a sense that he would be around and that he's faced many of these issues before, and that she and he would not be seeing a lot of things for the first time. On this question, I wouldn't quite categorize my book as suggesting that Democrats should run to the right of Republicans. It's more about how I think Democrats and liberals need to recapture their own foreign policy traditions, particularly those created at the dawn of the Cold War, which took totalitarianism seriously as a threat, but I think also had a very different conception of American virtue than you heard from the conservatives of the 1950s, and that you would sometimes hear from George W. Bush and Dick Cheney today. There are still areas where a Democrat will not only sound hawkish, but I think genuinely be hawkish. I mean, Afghanistan is one. John Kerry was hawkish on Afghanistan. Democrats have always supported the Afghan war as much as Republicans, and believe that, in fact, it's Republicans who are not as committed to Afghanistan as they should have been because they withdrew troops and sent them to Iraq. So I think Barack Obama has said he would move troops from Afghanistan to Iraq. Maybe
Iraq to Afghanistan.
Oh, sorry. Why do I keep doing that today? From Iraq to Afghanistan. Pakistan, to some degree, I think Democrats might call for getting tougher with Pervez Musharraf. Barack Obama talked about being willing to launch some kind of military strike in Pakistan, even if the Pakistanis weren't willing to go after an al-Qaeda target that we knew about. And then I think China is a kind of, outside the Middle East, but is kind of a perennial in American elections, where it's always good to say that you're going to be much, much tougher on China and turn the screws so that they don't keep taking our jobs. And then Bill Clinton did this in 1992. And then you get into office and you realize, in fact, that China is a very, very big, very powerful country with which we need to maintain good relations and over which we have much less influence than we would like to have and probably less influence than we used to have. There's been conversation in Democratic circles for a long time about how hard to go after Saudi Arabia, to try to run to the right of the Bush administration on Saudi Arabia. It was easier with Bush himself because his family had so many Saudi ties. I don't think it would quite pack quite as much punch against some other Republican in 2008.
Questions? Yes, in the back. Rick.
Just wanted to ask a question about Mr. Bloomberg as to, A, whether you thought he would throw his hat in, and, B, if he did, what effect it might have on the race.
Michael Makovsky in the middle here.
Hi. I have a question for Peter. You mentioned that you thought there was more realism on both sides, both parties, and less focus on democracy. And I was curious about, but when it came to Musharraf, my sense was that the Democrats talking more that there has to be a democratic process and good election in Pakistan. And while you heard that with some Republicans, I thought it was Romney, it became Clinton and said, well, we've got to support Musharraf because the alternative is bad. So it seemed like when we did have a problem with an unstable country, the Democrats were right for democracy. So I was just curious about what you think about that.
Any other questions? Oh, Dan, yes.
Thanks. You briefly, Michael, touched upon, you said Obama was a mystery, what he might do on the Israeli-Palestinian front. But in fact, do you expect that any new president would take a different stand than, well, basically pro-Israel, put the pressure on the Palestinian side, in his or her first term? Is anyone really going to make a change?
And lastly, we just had a conversation about Democrats running to the right of Republicans. So I wanted to ask Michael, we had a brief earlier exchange on your comments on Republicans who might run away from George W. Bush. But other than the Mike Huckabee comment, there doesn't seem to be among the major Republicans yet people really running away from George W. Bush. When you move into a general election, do you think that will happen? And on what sort of issue can you see Republican candidates moving out from the president?
Well, I think Republican candidates have moved away from the president, not by renouncing him or denouncing him, with the exception of the Huckabee statement in Foreign Affairs, but by taking different positions or taking on different subjects. And as I believe Peter noted, the stance that they're taking on Israel-Palestine type of issues is at least in tension with, if not in opposition to, the policy that Bush seems to be undertaking and has been for the past year or so. It's much more similar, in my view, to the steps that Bush was taking in 2002 and 2003 with respect to that issue. You noted, one of the questioners noted that the Democrats, in response to the Benazir Bhutto assassination and talking about General Musharraf, have been talking up we should have democracy in Pakistan. That is interesting because, there's a constant mantra in liberal thought that our problem in foreign policy is that we ally with right-wing fascist dictators, military rulers, and we should let the people have the voice, in which presumably they'll elect somebody that's kind of a more liberal and so forth. That was constantly a theme of the Democratic Party, including anti-war people in the Vietnam period and so forth. When Bush took up the cause, at least rhetorically, of democracy, Democrats started to take a different view. I remember an account of Bush's 2005 State of the Union message, rhetoric that he hasn't entirely lived up to, I'd say. Somebody was listening to it with Democratic staffers, and they were laughing and hooting and making fun of Bush's claims that we should advance democracy in the world. This was a figure of fun, contemptible, silly, and so forth. That's a different attitude from what the most people in the Democratic Party have taken historically, and I think it's an unfortunate one, even if you believe, as many Democrats and some Republicans do, that Bush set too high a set of goals, too high a bar, one that was leading to frustration. Will any new president follow the kind of policy that Bush did in 02, 03? Not necessarily. You know, I can see a president coming in who basically decides that, you know, we're going to threaten to withhold aid from Israel and muscle them unless they make concessions in Jerusalem or other places. You know, certainly Obama and some other people are not lacking for advisors who would tend to take that view. So I don't think it's inevitable that that go on. Michael Bloomberg. I've said this is a year of open field politics, and I think it's a year that's open to third-party candidates or independent candidates. Whether or not Bloomberg runs, I think, depends to a considerable extent on who the two major parties nominate and whether there seems to be an opening for a candidate whose issue profile is liberal on cultural issues, you know, has maintained the Giuliani tough crime programs, somewhat more conservative or market-oriented, perhaps, on economic issues. You know, the markets work well for him. I think there's also another name I would put forward as a potential candidate is Lou Dobbs of CNN. I think given, you know, various matchups of candidates, a candidate who was a strong, let's say you had Obama versus McCain to take two names that are possibles, a candidate who's anti-immigration, anti-free trade, might be able to find quite a lot of votes there. Lou Dobbs is well paid at CNN, but I gather he doesn't have an annual income, as Bloomberg does, of $500 million. But he could perhaps, in this age of the Internet, raise money and attract volunteers in order to be a visible and possibly competitive candidate.
I want to heartily agree with Michael. I think Lou Dobbs, it seems to me, is a formidable third-party candidate. Michael Bloomberg is not. I mean, third-party candidates need an issue. They need an issue that is too hot for either of the parties to grab hold of, and that's historically how they've managed to gain strength. You know, Perot had the deficit in 1992. Bloomberg doesn't have an issue. I mean, he has good management. Or maybe if he has an issue, it's an issue which is so unpopular, like I'm going to cut your Social Security, that nobody's going to want it. Lou Dobbs has an issue, and particularly if John McCain is the Republican nominee, because McCain is the most pro-immigration, or the Republican who is most suspect in the Republican base on the question of immigration. I think he would have a lot of room to run, because I think that the while we tend to segment. Immigration and trade in the political discourse, with Democrats expressing their anxieties about globalization through trade, and Republicans expressing them through immigration. In many ways, it's a false distinction. That there are enormous number of Americans in both parties and in no party, particularly those without college degrees, who are very skeptical of both high rates of immigration, certainly illegal immigration, and America's increasing role in the global economy. I think there would be a lot of room to run there. The problem for Bloomberg is he's a liberal Democrat, and Democrats are hungry to win. They are not. Ralph Nader has destroyed the idea of a left-wing, independent, third-party candidacy for a generation or more. Nobody is going to do anything that has the possibility of electing a Republican amongst liberal Democrats. And those are the people who Bloomberg actually agrees with. That's his ideology. On the question about Pakistan and realism, it's a very interesting and complicated question. I think. Obviously, when one is talking about the reaction to the Pakistan situation right now, a lot of it just has to do with the desire to be either anti-Bush or pro-Bush. So So Republicans aren't going to want to bash Bush on Pakistan. Democrats are going to look for an opportunity to be critical. And I think that has partly to do with how much emphasis they put on the question of how hard we should have pushed Musharraf. On the question of to what degree Democrats versus Republicans or liberals versus conservatives really believe in democracy, it's hard partly because I think that people often conflate terms like democracy and freedom with governments that like the United States. So, for instance, I have not heard an enormous amount of outrage amongst conservatives about the fact that we have developed this very close relationship with Libya. That seems to me is often pointed to by conservatives as one of the great Bush successes, but that's a total repudiation of the freedom agenda. And sometimes when I listen to George W. Bush and to conservatives in general, I sometimes think that they define freedom and democracy as countries that are sharing America's interests at that particular time. Although Democrats have been puzzled by Bush's rhetoric, and though I think both parties have moved in a realist direction in response to some very difficult outcomes in the Palestinian elections, in the Iraqi elections, even to some degree in the Iranian elections, I would argue that human rights is more in the liberal foreign policy DNA than it is in the conservative. I mean, Michael was rightly saying that I think conservatives are natural. The natural conservative perspective, I think, is to be more suspicious of the degree to which very different cultures can become like ours. I mean, I think that's Burkean, and I think that's where, although Bush and under the influence of a series of events that started happening under Ronald Reagan, when Ronald Reagan moved away from Marcos and in Latin America, I think in some ways the natural move for conservative foreign policy is to return to that view. Whereas I think Democrats are naturally a little more optimistic. And you know where you can see it? You can see it in this. You ask people in polls, liberals versus conservatives, do you believe that Islam is a religion of peace? Do you believe that Islam is compatible with democracy? Liberals and Democrats are much more likely to say that Islam is compatible with democracies than conservatives. It's very strange because Bush has launched this kind of rhetorical democratic crusade, but in fact, in polling shows that Republicans and conservatives are much more likely to think we are in a clash of civilizations than in fact liberals or Democrats are. And if you go back to the way that conservatives talked about the Cold War, conservatives very often talked about the Cold War as us being the West. In clash of civilization terms rather than in universal ideological terms. I think it's more natural for conservatives to do that. On the question of whether a president would be pro-Israel, a Democratic president would be pro-Israel, I think one has to always remember when one raises these kind of things that there is no settled view in the Israeli Knesset about what it means to be pro-Israel. There are quite radically different views, and I think the best way to understand how a Democrat versus a Republican would interpret what it means to be pro-Israel is that I think a Democrat would take their try to follow Bill Clinton's model. Aggressive intervention in the peace process. Maybe a little more pressure on Israel than some would like, but remember, Bill Clinton was very, very popular and is very popular in Israel. George W. Bush is also very popular in Israel, even though he pursued a very different strategy up until recently, far more hands-off. It's more likely that a Republican would take a hands-off position and a Democrat would be much more engaged, but I think both of those positions can be considered by many people to be pro-Israel.
Peter, before you leave the platform, we're going to close, but I just can't not ask you guys, and it'll just be amongst us and the television audience, of course. So, who's our next president?
If you know this, and 15 cents will buy you a cup of coffee. I mean, and $5 will buy you a cup of coffee. Well, I think if I had to say right now, I would say I think Barack Obama has a slight advantage over Hillary Clinton in the Democratic primary. He seems to be stronger in South Carolina, and he may even be a little stronger in Nevada. So I think it's more likely he goes into the big Super Tuesday states with a little bit of momentum, and he certainly has as much money as her. And if the African-American vote really does tip in his favor strongly, that gives him an enormous advantage. Democratic primaries are usually won by an alliance of more downscale white voters and African Americans. That's almost always what wins. The losing candidate is almost always the candidate of more upscale college-educated white voters. The losers are people like Bill Bradley, Paul Tsongas, Gary Hart, who appeal to NPR liberals, but don't appeal to white working class Democrats who want their interests protected and lose amongst African Americans. Walter Mondale, Al Gore, Bill Clinton, these are people who put together coalitions of working class whites who are much larger in the Democratic Party than people tend to remember, and African Americans. The reason Obama, I think, has such a good chance is that he could be the first candidate to put together a coalition of of college-educated whites, which is where he does well amongst whites, more upscale whites, and African Americans. And if you get that coalition, which no one has put together that I can think of, I don't know if Michael will correct me, that I can think of, maybe McGovern in 72, then I think actually... McGovern probably didn't even win the black vote. Then I think you can genuinely win. I think that's a majority. So I would give him a slight advantage over Hillary Clinton right now, although she has real pockets of strength in some places that'll vote on Super Tuesday. And then I would say you have to believe that Democrats have an advantage in the 2008 election over Republicans. First of all, it's not easy to win three straight presidential elections for one party. It doesn't happen very often. There's a natural pendulum swing. Particularly when the incumbent Republican president is unpopular, people are unhappy about the economy. Democrats are, the level of the enthusiasm gap between Democrats and Republicans is very real. I mean, look at the Iowa caucuses. Bush won Iowa in 2004. It's a very important swing state. I think Democrats had twice as many people who showed up at the caucuses than Republicans did. They're raising a lot more money. There is a very big passion gap in the Republican Party, between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. And that's why I think, although one can never be sure, I think Democrats have a natural kind of structural advantage in the 2008 election.
Michael?
Well, I addressed this a little earlier suggested to you that there are a lot of possible scenarios there. I think everything that Peter just said is a reasonable observation of the scene. Yeah, I'm not going to make a prediction. I've tried to write a few history books or at least narratives about past events. And one of the hardest things I've found when you're trying to write history is to see the world through the eyes of those who didn't know what was going to happen next. What did the world look like to Americans on December 6th, 1941? Hard to get yourself back in that frame of mind because you're thinking about what you're going to hear on the radio on Sunday afternoon. So I kind of savor these moments when I can explore alternative possibilities and scenarios, try to learn about what's moving voters here and there and so forth. And this discussion stimulated my thought on the Democrats' numbers don't change in the Christmas period. The Republicans' numbers do. Do the graph. It's fascinating. It's the stuff I stay up late doing. and I wouldn't learn as much if I knew who was winning. So even if God could come down and she would tell me who was going to be elected president, I would try and block my ears and not hear because I want to see the process go on. Ultimately, it's an intellectually trivial question. The day after the election, or in some cases 37 days after the election, any man and woman on the street can tell you who's going to be the next president of the United States. And any question that any person on the street can answer is an intellectually trivial question and a waste of time to ask somebody who's supposed to be an expert. So I'll pass. Thanks.
Well, I can only say that in my family, you would be the fifth person to call me an intellectually trivial questioner. So, Peter and Michael, thank you both very much for joining us today for what is a fascinating discussion. Thank you.